The Guardian.
Hello, film fans. I'm Jason Solomons, and this is Film Weekly. I suspect many of you out there have got a hidden desire to take up the camera and shoot your own movie, get it shown at a top film festival such as Raindance, and read a glittering review of your work in The Observer by myself. Well, tireless British director Michael Winterbottom has news for you.
I think the difficult thing will be to kind of really make a film where people watching it feel you wanted to make that film, that you're not doing it just because it's a competition, but you really wanted to make that.
Wise words there from the prolific but congested Michael Winterbottom. Michael's got news of a new short film competition for you to enter, so pens and paper at the ready a little later. Back in the studio is Guardian critic at large, Zan Brooks, joining me to dissect this week's releases, including Nick Cage in Bangkok Dangerous and Guy Ritchie's return to, what, in Rock and Roller. And we'll be measuring the high and low watermarks of the Venice Film Festival with critic Nick James. But first, in the director's chair is my new series of in-depth interviews with leading directors available to watch on guardian.co.uk. First in the series was Gurinder Chadha, and the second show focuses on the young British director Saul Dibb, who this week releases his second feature film, The Duchess. Saul's previous work includes TV documentaries, the critically acclaimed adaptation of The Line of Beauty, and the hard-hitting Bullet Boy. So I was keen to find out how he felt about taking on the particular challenges of wigs, makeup, and the very singular design issues at play when filming a period piece.
I personally think a lot of the things that people say about, you know, period films are costumes. You know, they're looking at the, in a way, the kind of superficial things. And I think what matters is the is the tone and the feel of it, and the power of it, and the costumes and the period setting makes sense of the story. I didn't feel like I was reading something about people who were 200 years ago. You know, it felt like something much more immediate, and I suppose that immediacy and that intimacy, I think, has strong parallels with the film that I made before, and probably the documentaries. And also the fact that it's about somebody trying to fight against this kind of social constrictions of the time.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think when you do something like Bullet Boy as well, an urban drama, you have to get the costumes just as right as you do when you're doing the Keira Knightley piece set 220 years ago. Because if you don't get the clothes right in Bullet Boy, that whole urban audience are going to laugh and say, well, you know...
Oh, absolutely. Almost it's more revealing because that kind of dialogue, everything, all those details are all around you, and it's very easy for people to say, well, you've got it wrong. And, you know, just because you do something that's contemporary, that is kind of broadly, I suppose, in the kind of realist tradition, doesn't mean that you don't make choices. I often think I make films for the same reason that I see films, which is to be transported into a completely different world and asked to see the world from somebody else's perspective, and that's part of the joys of documentaries, where you've got this kind of, it's kind of almost a vicarious pleasure, but, you know, of seeing other people's kind of reality and experience, and, you know, the more different they are, the better, as long as they feel truthful to that particular situation. And the thing is, you know, that the kind of human emotions that you're dealing with are universal.
There's this kind of a scary moment for you then, because there's a sort of pressure now to be commercially successful with The Duchess, which perhaps wasn't there in your first film, Bullet Boy.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, Bullet Boy cost about $1.5 million. And it's probably more important for a first film, for a director, to get good critical reviews than it is for it to make money. I think people will let you make the first one, maybe the second one, and allow it not to make money. And I think it probably got its money back, you know. You know, there is that pressure, but I don't think of it in those terms. You know, I think of it still in the same terms of making the film work, and if the film will work with those people in it, then you hope it's going to be a success.
Saul Dibb in conversation with me there. And The Duchess is on release across the UK from Friday the 5th of September. You can, of course, hear and see the full glorious colour interview with me and Saul on guardian.co.uk/video. Zan Brooks, Guardian film critic at large, and large Guardian film critic, joins me in the film pod.
Getting welcome larger back by the second, and this is pre-lunch.
Yeah, well, you could earn your lunch by going through with me some of the films of the week. We've got Keira Knightley in The Duchess. We've got Rock and Roller, which is Guy Ritchie back on the big screen. Bangkok Dangerous with Nick Cage and a new haircut. And Never Apologise. Let's start with The Duchess, which is Saul Dibb, after Bullet Boy, a new feature, a big costume drama, a costume epic. How did he go from Bullet Boy to Keira Knightley and the procession of wigs that is The Duchess?
Gee, this is Charlotte, and she'll be staying with us.
Why?
Because her mother is dead and she has no other place to go.
Have you fathered that child?
It's only a little girl, G. It's hardly the end of the world.
Zan, The Duchess. Did it seem an easy transition from Bullet Boy to this?
Yes, it weirdly did. I think Saul Dibb is a very professional filmmaker. He knows exactly what he's doing. You know, if you're confident in what you're doing, then it doesn't matter whether you're kind of, you know, running around the mean streets of Hackney or the stately homes of old-time England, which is what he's doing here.
Yeah.
So it's a very confident, polished, plush costume drama.
I think so too, and I quite enjoyed it. I've even seen it twice. The reason I saw it twice, Zan, was because I couldn't quite remember really what was going on and what happened. It seemed to me that I'd seen all of this sort of thing before, that this was a very competently done version of the things I'd done before. I was slightly disappointed that a very promising young British film director who seemed to have something to say about the times had kind of been forced, just by the way the industry works, to go back and doing this sort of stuff.
It's difficult. It's almost like the material is so heavy that it kind of dictates what you do with it, that you can't redo that much. I remember, you know, 15 years ago when Martin Scorsese went and made The Age of Innocence, yep, and it was, he's going to do something radically different with this kind of stuffy old world. And he didn't. He just made a very nicely directed professional film. This is what Saul Dibb has done with The Duchess. It's not radical. It's not revolutionary. But I kind of think the form dictates the content in a way.
I feel that he has done all this very well, with a little bit of, you know, he's kind, yes, of, you know, spruced it up into, there are some lovely camera moves in it.
There's lovely camera moves, and there is at least kind of vague stabs at a modern sensibility, a kind of modern interpretation.
He hasn't
of,
done
of
what
this material.
Sophia Coppola did with her Marie Antoinette, for
no,
example, roughly
not at
the
all.
Same era, actually, kind of just slightly pre-revolution, this is.
Yeah, there's no kind of Adamant songs in here or anything.
No, I was kind of looking at them because Keira Knightley, who I think is probably at her best ever that we've seen here. She's growing into herself, if not the corsets that that kind of constrict her here. But I think she carries a movie and does bring, I think, with her, because she is sort of a modern British woman, she brings that element of...
Yeah, the movie is to a degree a kind of, you know, love letter to Keira Knightley. She carries the movie. She's in virtually every single scene of the film.
Yeah, that would put a lot of people off, a love letter to Keira Knightley.
Yes, exactly. And yet she copes well with it. Mm. She does well. And yes, perhaps that's where you get the kind of slight modern sensibility in here. There's a little bit of kind of Madame Bovary quality to this. There's a slight sort of feminist take on the kept woman, the woman who actually has no power. She has incredible kind of personal power, but no actual political power. So she's sort of trapped here. And Keira does that well, I think.
Yeah, I think she does it. The story is, of course, about Ralph Fiennes, the Duke of Devonshire, who takes for him a young wife, who is Keira Knightley, and then takes for him a mistress, who's played by Hayley Atwell, far bustier than Keira Knightley. It's always as if he's kind of preferred more of a décolleté than a flatter lady. And they live together as a threesome. And then the publicity for this film, when I first got it through The Duchess early in the summer, sort of said, there are three people in this marriage.
Yes, well, have you seen the trailer? The trailer is almost guilty of false advertising, I think, which is basically Diana, Diana, Diana. Oh, but it's actually not a film about Diana.
Because it really isn't a film.
It's really not a film about Diana.
Very unfair, I thought.
I mean, you know, yes, they are distantly related. Yes, they both married older men. So
yeah, as are and do all posh people.
Exactly. So I kind of think the marketing people are kind of milking a bit of a cash cow.
Yeah, but I think they've made a bit of a vault fast. I think they've kind of thought, actually, that's not quite the really... Because Diana, as Keira herself has said in an interview, she goes, I was 11 when Princess Diana died. I don't really care about her that much.
But maybe they're imagining that the sort of audience that goes to see a plush costume drama are going to be mad Diana files.
Yeah, no, this is the other thing that worried me. Who goes to see these things now? Why Wake the Duchess? Do we need the Duchess?
this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, that, do that audience actually go to the cinema, or are they going to wait to see this on kind of BBC One on a Sunday evening and you know, say, oh, how marvellous that was. I can't think why I didn't go along to the cinema to see that. Possibly. But it's a good film. It's a sort of solid film. I had slight problems, weirdly, with its feminist take, which kind of tipped into this sort of plea for tolerance. There's the classic thing is the Ralph Fiennes character, who gives a sort of marvellously dry, sort of self-disgusted performance as the Duke. But at the end, they humanise him, they sympathise him, without giving too much away. You know, basically the implication is it's a sort of plea for tolerance on behalf of the upper class. It's basically saying they're just as much a prisoner of the class system as we are.
Yes, indeed as Ashley Waters was in Bullet Boy.
Yeah, exactly, except that they have slightly more money than Ashley Waters did and bigger houses to feel kind of alone in.
Absolutely, but you have to get the clothes just right either way. Let us move on to probably an area that perhaps we have more dominion over. Guys, geezers and drugs and guns. It is, of course, Guy Ritchie back to his usual tricks in Rock and Roller, the story of a Russian gangster overtaking London from Tom Wilkinson and trying to find his lost painting.
Yeah, I've took it off the easel and I'll put it on the wall. Yeah, it looks mag... Archie, I've been robbed.
What? Hello?
I said I've been robbed. Yeah, I don't know when. It's the painting. Yeah, it's the one that Yuri gave me.
Archie, this is not good. That's his favourite painting. His lucky painting.
So, Rock and Roller, as we can hear from that, is right back into the bugle-heavy world.
He's back in his manner, isn't he?
Yeah, mate. Yeah, nice whistles, man.
Back in his manner, even though, you know, this is obviously a man who grew up on one country estate and now lives on another.
So he's actually the Duchess.
He's got more in common with Ralph Fiennes' Duke than Mr. Knuckles. But, you know, here he is back again doing what he does best, which is you know, a slightly double-edged compliment, perhaps, damning him with faint praise. This is, you know, oh, God, he knows what he's doing. This is a decent stab at going back to Lock, Stock and Snatch. He's a magpie, isn't he, Guy Ritchie? He's a wannabe and he's a magpie and he's lifting from Long Good Friday here. He's lifting from performance. He's lifting from a bit of Scorsese. He's lifting from better films than he makes.
Yeah, I think this kind of shows him. I thought the first 40 minutes was all right. I was kind of, I don't mind this genre when it's done okay. And I thought Lock, Stock had a certain larky laddishness and humour to it, essentially. And you wanted these four, five boys to kind of do well and kind of, you know, escape kind of being done by the elders of the gangster world. My problem with Rock and Roller is that nobody's nice in it.
No, no one's nice at all. And I guess he would say that is what that world's like, because he knows that world. And, you know, we were talking weirdly earlier about Goodfellas before we start recording. And Goodfellas is another film that shows basically everybody in that world as louses and scum and, you know, utterly untrustworthy, venal, unpleasant, murderous psychopaths. And yet Goodfellas has a distance from it. Goodfellas shows you this world. It's almost like a kind of anthropological documentary on it. It shows you how this world works, the mechanics of it, and then it shows how it all goes to hell.
And there's that wonderful Scorsese journey to hell and some kind of redemption as well. Guy Ritchie's film...
Guy Ritchie's wants to be one of these people. You never get the sense that he doesn't. There's no distance here. He's kind of swaggering around and trying to kind of talk in that argot. And, you know, basically he's like somebody at a wild party saying, look, and I'll introduce you to my mate here and I'll introduce you to this mate here. And, yeah, there's no distance. And so because of that, these unpleasant people, you just think there's no escape from them.
I think
them.
He has
no
nothing to say
out.
About this
world. Of course
world,
he does.
All the glamour of this world or whatever it is. And there's also, it seemed like a crucial lack of humour here. There's no jokes in it at all. And it seems to me that at least amongst thieves, there's honour and banter.
You'd think that. I mean, I think Guy Ritchie would disagree with that and would say that there is a humour in the banter. He does love his kind of gangster slang. And he's certainly going for a kind of slight Pinter-esque quality with some of the dialogue.
You could have seen Harold Pinter himself playing the Tom Wilkinson character.
Absolutely, yeah, and probably better than Tom Wilkinson, who looks a little ill at ease, I think, in this world. There are some decent bits, again, that kind of remind you of slightly better movies. There's a very nice kind of dance sequence with Tandy Newton and Gerard Butler that makes you think, oh, yeah, they did that in Pulp Fiction, and that was kind of good.
Yeah, and also they have got this painting that's the sort of centre of the MacGuffin. You never see the actual painting. Everyone sort of goes, oh, Pulp Fiction, the briefcase, the gold, we don't see
exactly,
what's in it.
Exactly, yeah. So he's can we say stealing? I think we can because it's a gangster film.
You can say arf-inching.
Arf-inching, right, borrowing, isn't he? He's going to give it back.
The thing was, again, it becomes quite apparent to me that this is just a big pose, this film. They all talk about, I'm in for him 7 large, here's 10 large, I want 20 large off him. I'm thinking, how large is large? Do you really know what large is? And then at one point someone says, here's 2 large to get tongues wagging. And he sort of gives him a sort of large bundle of £10 notes. Well, 2 large is obviously 2 grand. And then a Russian gangster saying, oh, he's in for 7 large. Does a Russian gangster really care about 7,000 pounds?
You're right. It's a total pose. I mean, we're all talking from a slight position of ignorance. I mean, I'm not in with gangland London, at least not since I fell out with Mr. Knuckles. But I think possibly I'm slightly more au fait with it than Guy Ritchie is. And Guy, it's the blind leading the blind. He's basically presuming on no knowledge about this world at all, in which case you can do what the hell you want with it. He could have had a space alien running on at one stage, and most of the idiots who are going to watch this film said, oh, yeah, because there is one of those down at Dog and Duck every night, and if you cross him, he'll kick your ass.
It will. As well, I was also thinking that there's a Russian gangster element come in, that there was sort of echoes of Eastern Promises as well, which I think is a far better movie and stylized movie about this. And also, I saw this film, I'd just come from having my flat valued. And it turns out it was 100 grand less worth this week than it was 2 weeks
that
ago.
That puts you in the right frame of mind.
I was in a bad mood, and then I get in there and it starts going, the London property market is soaring upwards. It's the richest in the world. I'm thinking, Guy, yeah.
And they're saying the only way is up.
Yeah, you're off the pace before we've even started.
Yeah, I mean, this is going for the Longwood Friday zeitgeist-catching moment of the city. Mm. And it's busting from 2006. It's already 2 years out of date.
Rock and Roller is rolling out across the country on Friday. Also on our screens this weekend is Nicolas Cage as an assassin in Bangkok Dangerous.
My job takes me to a lot of places. The work is steady, the money's good, but it's not for everyone. My name's Joe. This is what I do.
Purpose of your visit to Bangkok, Mr. Winston?
Holiday.
How many people have you killed?
I don't think about that.
Do the police know who you are?
No one knows who I am.
This guy, he fight bad guys and helps the poor.
Political assassination wasn't in the contract.
Yes.
We had an arrangement. If I see your people again, I'll kill you.
Zan, Bangkok Dangerous, Notting Hill, Bourgeois.
Yes, obviously East End of London, very dangerous as well, as we've already established. But Bangkok, probably even more dangerous, particularly when Nicolas Cage's assassin is in town.
What's he doing there?
He's got a job to do, hasn't he? I mean, he's got a job to do, someone's got to do the job. And this time it's Nicolas Cage in quite an alarming hairdo. I don't know how this helps his assassin credentials, but maybe it adds the sort of fear factor.
It's sort of the hair that sort of seemed to change and recede during the filming as well. It started out a bit Ken Doddish, and by the end...
There's nothing more scary than an assassin who looks like Ken Dodd.
Yeah, that duster, you want to watch it. It's got a poison tip. He's that sort of assassin we've seen in movies before, the kind of Leon assassin, the loner, the guy who has to make no friends. And
right back to Le Samurai, the great Alain Delon film from the 1960s. Yes, and so this has probably been done to death, I guess, quite literally. It's by the Pang brothers, and it's based on a film that I haven't actually seen, and it's a remake, it's a Hollywood remake of the film, but apparently they've changed it in
It's their own film, though, isn't it?
It's their own
film. Bangkok Dangerous from, 1999, which I have seen, can't remember much of, except it was very violent, I do remember that, quite stylish and violent, and they must think they're Michael Haneke here remaking their own stuff.
Or, auspiciously, the guy who remade The Vanishing, the great Dutch film.
George Schluser.
Who then went over and remade it in Hollywood and completely screwed it up. I guess if somebody's going to screw up your film, it might as well be you. And the Pang brothers have kind of certainly done that. It's a sort of willful act of self-vandalism, I guess.
They're also rather worrying. I know they're big, big cheeses in Thailand, which is not a good place to be a dairy product. They have done a film called Shutter as well, which was recently remade in Hollywood, starring Jessica Alba as a blind violinist. In here we have a deaf-mute pharmacist for whom Nick Cage falls.
Well, she can't hear him, can she?
Which is handy if you're trying to knock people off behind her. You can do your job and she doesn't even bother.
And she can't tell you to go away. So he can just hang around and bother her for as long as he wants. It's the perfect date for Nick Cage. Apparently in the original film, the deaf-mute was actually the assassin.
Yeah, that's right. I was very confused by this. Yeah, you're right.
But obviously it's not in Nick Cage's contract that he would play a deaf-mute, because then he doesn't get many lines, you see. And he's the star. So the deaf-mute becomes this slightly ludicrous, hapless, insipid, soulful pharmacy assistant who, yes, he steps out with.
Bangkok Dangerous, starring Nicolas Cage, out on Friday. Re-released alongside that this week is Never Apologise, which sees Malcolm McDowell back on the screen doing his one-man show, his tribute to his great mentor, Lindsay Anderson.
Congratulations. You are going to star in the next Lindsay Anderson film. I wanted to work with him. I knew he was the master. If you worked with Lindsay, there was a vocabulary that went with it. Awful. God, it's awful. Yeah, brilliant. There was a group of us around Lindsay. We used to call ourselves the old crowd. And it was amazing and it was real. So I reached across and kissed her, and our teeth banged together, and as I looked at her, I realized that there was blood coming. I wasn't sure whether it was hers or mine. But as it was pre-AIDS, it didn't really matter.
Zan, the company of Malcolm McDowell throughout a one-man show is something to behold.
It really is, and it's actually kind of something kind of wonderful to behold. This is a wonderful sort of loving, affectionate portrait, and loving and affectionate aren't words I would necessarily associate with Malcolm McDowell.
Or Lindsay Anderson.
Both of whom are fairly kind of cold-blooded monsters in their time. But this is a great tribute. And there's also something kind of impressive. It's almost like the actor's art right on the line here. He's standing up at a lectern. That's basically all the film is. Just him at the lectern speaking. And speaking with passion, with fondness, with sadness. And it's the sort of film that, even if you don't really like Lindsay Anderson or don't know too much about Lindsay Anderson, I think it still kind of works. It certainly made me want to go and revisit some of his films.
Well, it certainly takes you back to a certain time in British cinema. Obviously, when that came out, The Great Public School Rebel, then it deals with those scenes very well. The scenes in the cafe when he's fighting Christine Noonan, who I've also fell in love with, as well as Malcolm McDowell, but it also takes us back to Oh Lucky Man and Britannia Hospital, but all
and
through
this sporting
that,
life.
This sporting life, of course, with Richard Harris. So all of that is in there. You sort of get a history, not just of British cinema, but a history of a certain Britishness seems to emerge.
Absolutely.
Through it.
And perhaps that's why there's a sort of odd, sad quality to this film as well. It had that slight kind of Last of the Mohicans style to it, in that here is an actor who was, you know, the great white hope of British cinema, talking about a director who is the great white hope of British cinema, who's now dead and has been dead for 15 years. And with that, a certain strain of British cinema has gone. This was iconoclastic, uncompromising, radical British cinema, and radical in a way that Guy Ritchie could never hope to be. And now it's gone. And it's looking back on that, not in a kind of maudlin way, not even in a overly romantic way, just in I was there and here it is.
Yeah, and it isn't one of those like jazz documentaries where they say, well, he was a cad who could really play and I saw Charlie Parker for the first time. This is kind of really kind of just beautiful anecdotes inserted almost randomly and tantalising.
Yeah, this is a real personal take. So it's not Malcolm McDowell explaining why Lindsay Anderson was very significant for British cinema. It's Malcolm McDowell talking about drunken meals that he had with Lindsay Anderson, where Lindsay Anderson was slagging off everybody at the table and people were storming off in high dudgeon. It's a lot more interesting than a kind of film buffs documentary.
And the one lesson that you should take away from Never Apologise is, apart from Never Apologise, of course, which is John Wayne's message in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, the one message that I took away from Never Apologise is, you don't want to play cricket with Harold Pinter.
Absolutely not. The other message is, it makes me want to watch Oh Lucky Man again.
Let's do that. And Never Apologise is getting a limited release. It's on at the Curzon Soho and at a few screens around the country, so look out for it. You can find out where it's on by going to www.neverapologise.com to find out about Malcolm McDowell and his impressions of Betty Davis and John Ford and John Gielgud. And believe me, and Zan, they're very worth hearing. Zan, you mentioned there when we were talking about Never Apologise that you wanted to see Oh Lucky Man again. Well, you could if you voted for it as one of your films to save for future generations. For that is what the BFI have launched this week. The films for tomorrow, they asked me as well, which film I wanted to preserve for the next 75 years to share this time in 75 years. Other people have chosen. Cate Blanchett went for Stalker, a very refined choice, Tarkovsky's Stalker there. Ken Loach went for Yuri Menzel's Closely Observed Train, while Bill Nighy chose Mississippi Burning, and Matt Lucas of Little Britain chose Billy Elliot. Sam, what would you choose?
I'm absolutely torn by this, and I always take this thing very seriously and get very kind of anxious about it, as if it really says something about me. I note that Stephen Frears chose The Third Man, which seems a very good choice, because it's on one level it's a very slick, satisfying film noir thriller, and on another level it seems to say something about the world and the world when it was made and the world that we're still kind of like dealing with the ramifications of, I guess. In terms of Britishness, I might go for a Powell and Pressburger. I might actually go for A Canterbury Tale,
which
I think is one of their lesser-known films, but I think it's perhaps the film that most captures a certain kind of English quality in a way that no other film has kind of done.
It's a beautiful film. Slightly mad as
well.
It's
a very strange, very eccentric film, and it involves evacuees, soldiers and people being based in Canterbury during the war. It's shot in the kind of ruins of Canterbury Cathedral and all around there. And it pivots around a guy who throws glue on women's heads, which is a very kind of weird, dark Michael Powell touch. But it's a beautiful film. Either that or, on the sort of film noir tip, maybe Chinatown, Roman Polanski's great film about the birth of modern-day Los Angeles. I'd have to flip a coin.
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, I had to choose between Goodfellas, which we mentioned earlier, and maybe a Spike Lee film and a Woody Allen film. But I went for This Is England because I think, I thought that was England and this is England. It will still be England when we show it.
And it's particularly the England that we know and that we grew up with and that I guess kind of has defined us to a certain degree, although you've lost the skinhead.
It's got Mrs. Thatcher, the Falklands, and Roland Rand in it, which is my childhood.
In a nutshell.
The Falklands was hard for me.
It was. You coped well there.
Thank you very much. So you two can play. The reason I mention it here is that you two can play the BFI's game. They're really looking for a kind of definitive selection here. There are 75 people will have chosen them, including myself and Gurinder Chado chose Tokyo Story, and Lawrence of Arabia was the choice of Sir Roger Moore. That was an eyebrow-raising moment there. You can't see that on the podcast. But voting is open till the 30th of September, and the BFI announced the highest polling films in October, and then the top five choices will be screened at the BFI South Bank from January 2009 and go around the country. So you will see the top five films that people have preserved from that list. So you can enter at www.bfi.org.uk/75. That's bfi.org.uk/75. Get debating. Zan, a huge thanks to you as ever.
Jason, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And you can read Zan's views and reviews at guardian.co.uk/film. As you know, I've been stranded here in London covering for the great Philip French in The Observer, and the person who's been covering for me at the Venice Film Festival is Nick James, editor of Sight and Sound. Nick, you join me on the line now. How's it been standing in my shoes?
Oh, it's been wonderful. I'm not usually the sort of person who does gossip, for example, but that's been quite entertaining for me. And but I have to say that you picked a good year not to be here in some ways.
That pains me.
Yes, I mean, last year was, I think, one of the best Venice festivals I'd ever been to. This year, sadly, is a bit lacklustre by comparison.
I mean, that's the impression we're getting here from sort of slightly fed-up hacks coming from the Lido. Is that why is that slightly sort of dampened the spirits?
Well, it was many, many days before we saw anything that we could even claim to be very good. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of quite weak films. I mean, I suppose the Coen brothers' opening film was quite good, but it was a minor Coen Brothers, and this is called Burn After Reading, the satire on the CIA.
You kind of enjoyed it from your review in The Observer last Sunday.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. It was fun, but it is, you know, it's one of the Coen smaller films, and it did have a slight feel of being made in a hurry, but it was very funny.
Yeah, and you got George and Brad on a red carpet, and that, you know, that gets the front pages
right.
here.
That's right.
I was looking down the list at sort of the Americans, and there was Catherine Bigelow, who I've got a sort of great sort of soft spot for as a director. She was returning for the first time for ages with a film there.
Yeah, there's good word on this, but I don't see it. In fact, I won't see it at all because I'll be on a flight home when they're showing it tomorrow morning.
Right.
But I have just seen Jonathan Demme's new film.
Ah, yeah, well, another great
Rachel
Maverick.
Getting Married with Anne Hathaway in it, which is... I have to say that the wedding genre is not one of my favourites, but this is one of the best I've seen since Robert Altman's The Wedding.
Right.
It has a really, really brilliant screenplay written by somebody quite young, I think, a young Lumet, I'm not sure.
I think it's a grandson of Sidney Lumet.
Yeah, that's right. And it's about the sister of the woman getting married, Rachel's getting married, her sister, played by Anne Hathaway, is in recovery from drug and drink addiction and is an explosively neurotic character. It could get very, very icky very fast. And there are times when you think it's just about to make you feel sick. And every time, it undercuts itself beautifully.
Well, any kind of works of great weight and intellectual kind of heft that are there to challenge people like yourself, Nick?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are. There's two, I think, rather strong films. The one that I'm most excited about today, I suppose, is Paper Soldier by Alexei German Jr., a Russian director. And this is one of the weirdest and strangest and most beautiful-looking films you could possibly find. And it has constant dialogue, which will contrast things. Say I said, oh, Jason's just hanged himself. I must sort out the patio, you know. It's got those sorts of juxtapositions where something really dramatic is said, followed by something totally banal.
Yeah.
And which might put people off, but actually... This is an extraordinary film for manipulating the helicopters, the trucks, the lighting, the sea. It's about a medical officer who's looking after Yuri Gagarin and the other first cosmonauts.
Wow.
And this medical officer is absolutely in mental torment because he's training these guys and they might just burn to death in space.
Now, this sounds like something I'd really fancy. Because, I mean, the Banishment, which was at Cannes a couple of years ago and is now out here in the UK, seemed to baffle a lot of people. That's by Zviagintsev, who won for The Return at Venice a couple of years ago. These Russians, we hope they love their children too back in the 80s, but they clearly love their movies at the moment because they make the strangest and most challenging films around, I think.
Yeah, and another really good one for the more sort of intellectually inclined is called Bird Watchers, and it's really about the Guarani Indians. And if it sounds a bit worthy, it's not. It's got a brilliant opening and a brilliant closing, and the structure of the whole thing is wonderful. What happens is these Guarani Indians are on the reservation. There's not much of the forest left because the landowners have cut it all down to make ethanol or whatever. They decide to try and take their land back. And so this creates a culture clash between a fairly well-meaning farmer and his daughter and his family and this group of Guarani Indians. It's a little bit smaller than, you know, I started raving about it and then suddenly people would go and see it and say, well, it's good, but it's not that good, if you know what I mean. So I'm a bit concerned not to overburden.
Well, no, but these stories work a certain magic on the individual, I think, films
yeah,
like that, you know,
yes,
and you seem to have taken it, it earned a special place in your heart.
Yeah.
Nick, I'm going to let you go and
okay.
have lunch with Marco Muller, the big boss of Venice. Will you be challenging him on saying, Marco, come on, why this year on the Pound?
I will say, why are there so few films here that are of the highest quality? And he will no doubt tell me, and I will try and let the Observer readers know on Monday.
Excellent.
Maybe not Sunday.
Sunday would be better,
yeah,
really,
it
for
would,
them.
Would. It would.
I look forward to seeing your reviews as ever. Nick James, editor of Sight and Sound. You can read him in the Observer on Sunday, as he said. Molto grazie.
Tu.
Finally, on Film Weekly, the 16th Raindance Film Festival launched this week and told us it would be kicking off on the 1st of October right here in London. A key objective of this festival is to enable and encourage people to make films, and it's with this in mind that they've launched a new film competition called Short Circuit. Yes, if you've the imagination, a camera, and even some of the editing skills to put together just 60 seconds of moving images, you are in with the chance to get screened at Raindance. I met up with one of the supporters of the festival and one of the jury judges, Michael Winterbottom, to find out about Short Circuit. Michael, how does one enter, and why are you the figurehead for this?
Well, I'm not the figurehead, I don't think. I'm just, I was asked, did I want to watch the films and be one of the judges? So the idea is anyone can enter. It's you can make a film of any sort. It can be fiction, documentary, animation, yeah. But it can only be 1 minute long. And the 10 winners get to screen their films at the Raindance Film Festival.
And then I think the gold ribbon prize is to go to Cannes after that.
Yeah, that's either the good thing or the bad thing, depending on how you look at it. I think the more important thing is that you get to show your films with an audience, with an enthusiastic audience at the Raindance, you know. And then, yeah, one person gets the added pleasure of a week on the French Riviera.
You personally seem very equipped to judge this because you've done so many different genres and so many different on-the-hoof kind of styles, but also kind of more kind of studio works. You've done kind of digital works. Is it important for filmmakers to kind of make the virtues out of necessity? Because it seems that's what you've done on the last 10 films.
I think it's important to make films you want to make. You know, I think, you know, from my point of view, I just try and make the films that I want to make. And I think if you're doing a sort of film like this, where it's 1 minute, I think the difficult thing would be to kind of really make a film where people watching it feel you wanted to make that film, that you're not doing it just because it's a competition, but you really wanted to make that. Yeah. And I think that's the hardest thing about any film. When you watch a film, you want to really feel like the people who made the film were passionate about the film they're making.
Yeah. How did you start? Did you start doing shorts?
I didn't really, so I'm a very bad person in a way for this competition. I started kind of watching films and then I went to sort of did a kind of 12-month course. I suppose I made shorts there in a way, but then really started more in TV and kind of came out. I was an assistant film editor, then a researcher, director, so kind of went more through a TV route.
So do you feel there's Raindance is kind of going from strength to strength. 16 years it's been going. There's clearly a strong well of film culture that is growing in England, in the UK, sorry.
I hope so. I think, you know, festivals like Raindance are important in kind of bringing people together and kind of creating an enthusiasm for independent films, for short films and so on. And I think probably there are more and more people making films. Certainly, you know, we have a company where a lot of young people come through and we're always encouraging them to go out and make shorts. And so we see a lot of shorts, you know, that they do. I think the difficult area is like where to show them, you know. Like, I know lots of people who like they made their shorts, they made two or three shorts, but it kind of comes to the point of like, well, what to do with them, you know. And hopefully things like the internet can provide a kind of extension of festivals. So instead of there just being a festival for 2 weeks in a year, there are places that you can meet other people making films, show your films to them, they can watch, you can watch their films, and kind of create a more sense of interaction between filmmakers and audience, you know. And so I know Raindance Film Festival's got Raindance TV, you know, there's Daily Motion, which are the other people kind of all the festival have their own kind of platform for short films, and I think that's what would be good, is like more places to watch films.
You it's very rare that we've managed to grab you for 5 minutes. You're full of cold, and thank you very much for talking to us. It's rare I say that, because you're not shooting today, and normally you are filming and making another film. You've got Geneva is done, it's going to be released soon. What can we expect from that?
Well, Geneva is going to show in Toronto. It's going to be premiere in Toronto, and then at London Film Festival. I think apparently Boris Johnson's screening at London Film Festival should be fun. but then we're doing a documentary with Naomi Klein based on her book, The Shock Doctrine. And to be honest, one of the reasons I'm really free at the moment is that until 2 days ago, we were in pre-production on a film called A Beautiful Game, which is about gangs in Manchester. And we cast it all. Noel Clark was going to be in it, and Kano was going to be in it, and lots of other people. And getting locations, and unfortunately, money's just fallen through. So we're concentrating now on the documentary.
But even for you, these things happen.
Disasters are always lurking.
So no plans to go back and do a studio movie? That sounds, again, sort of on the hoof kind of bit of film. Or is that more of a less of a documentary kind of?
No, it was a fiction. It was like a kind of sort of gangster film in a way. Right. But no, there's lots of other things. Well, usually we have like two or three ideas we want to make. Yeah. But obviously a film takes, you know, usually a film's like takes a year to make. So when one falls through at the last minute, you're like, oh, fuck.
That's why you got to be prepared and have other ones up your sleeve, which you always seem to do. Michael, thanks for joining us. Good luck with Short Circuit, and good luck watching all the short films that are coming your way.
Thanks very much.
And the Short Circuit Film Competition, which will be awarded by Michael Winterbottom when the Raindance Film Festival is up and running between the 1st and the 12th of October, is now open. As of today, you can enter the Short Circuit Film Competition. There's 10 films are going to be shortlisted and screened at Raindance in October. That's 10 directors are going to receive a pass to the complete programme at Raindance and a 12-month membership for raindance.tv. Runners-up get £500 worth of training, but the best short film director will win a one-week trip for two to the Cannes Film Festival in 2009, including accreditation, accommodation, flights and access to Raindance events. Amazing. As Michael says, it could be a major turning point in your filmmaking career. For more details on how to put these things on a good format and how to enter, go to www.raindance.co.uk. That's raindance.co.uk. We want your entries now. Last week, you might remember, we ran a competition for the excellent soundtrack to The Whackness, Jonathan Levine's nostalgic film set to the glorious sounds of early 90s New York hip-hop. I wanted to know what The Whackness actually means. I had a wonderful response. Your emails to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk came flooding in. David Thompson from Fenwick Street in York and Ronan Culhane, they knew the answer. It means that which is bad, as opposed to the dopeness, which means that which is good. So The Whackness means bad stuff, and well done to you, Ronan and David. Soundtracks are on their way to you hippity-hoppity quick. Thanks to all my guests this week, to Zan Brooks, to Michael Winterbottom, and of course to Saul Dibb. Thanks to you for listening. From me and my producer Jason Phipps, we'll see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.